We're going to start this morning with a little Christmas game of trivia. We're going to do the top 10 Christmas villains in Christmas movies, okay? So I'm going to give you the villain, and you give me the movie. Top 10, starting with number 10. Number 10 is a kid named Scott Farkas. What movie was he in? You don't know? He was a bully. They like to throw snowballs. A Christmas Story. Come on, Scott Farkas. How about this one? Hans Gruber is a famous villain in what movie? Die Hard. Takes everyone hostage during the office Christmas party to get his hands on the money. What about these are two of my favorites? Marv and Harry. Home Alone. Can't forget. Marv and Harry still makes me laugh every single time. How about this adorable villain? Bumble. Looks kind of like a Yeti. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Good job. How about this one? The Angry Elf. Remember the Angry Elf? In Elf. Good job. You guys are so bright. Nothing, I can't give you, the name of the movie is the villain in this one, but nothing ruins Christmas like these little creatures that if you feed after midnight get you in trouble. Gremlins, that's right. Christmas movie Gremlins. This character named Old Man Potter is one of the most nostalgic villains in Christmas movies. Maybe the grouchiest and most hard-hearted of all in Bedford. What was his name? Or what movie was that? Old Man Potter. You don't know? You have to know. Bedford, George Bailey. It's a Wonderful Life. Come on. So disappointing. This villain named Jack Frost scares, there we go, Santa Claus 3. I like that. That is correct. Just two words for this villain and you'll get this. Bah humbug. Ebenezer Scrooge, A Christmas Carol. And then our number one most notorious villain in all Christmas movies lived above Whoville and stole Christmas. The Grinch, who stole Christmas. Christmas villains. They find their way into our Christmas movies, but villains are not uncommon to the Christmas story. The original Christmas story found in the scriptures includes a notorious villain who tried to remove Christ from Christmas. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm one of those guys that Christian cliches sometimes drive me nuts a little bit. One Christmas Christian cliche, that's a mouthful, that you see a lot is the little bumper sticker, or you'll see it on church signs, keep Christ in Christmas, right? That's a cliche that you see a lot. Now we have the ability as City Church to be able to put cliches on our church sign. If we have any volunteer that would like to change the sign, just let me know. We just have to make sure that we give approval to what goes on the sign. There's a lot of little cliches that pop up during the Christmas season. One common one that you'll see is wise men still seek him. Anybody ever seen that? I think we're to the point like there's so many bumper stickers and signs that those sayings kind of lose their factor. You know what I'm saying? Like I don't see that sign anymore. Wise men still seek him and think, that's good. I've seen it way too many times. Keep Christ in Christmas has kind of lost that hum factor. Or Jesus is the reason for the season has kind of lost its wow factor, I would say. But keep Christ in Christmas is a very common cliche that you will see, and one that came out several years ago now, I would say it was more popular a couple of decades ago, that caused a lot of controversy among the Christian community, is it would be very common to see the expression, Merry Xmas. And we got into a big uproar over Merry Xmas, because a lot of people thought this was an attempt to take Christ out of Christmas, Merry Xmas. And there's this constant conversation that happens in our culture about whether Christ should be in Christmas or not. recently, it kind of showed its face in the last few years on whether people should say Merry Christmas when you're at Target or at Starbucks or wherever you may be. Do the employees, should they say Merry Christmas or should they say Happy Holidays? There was a big push away from saying Merry Christmas, and a lot of Christians got uptight about it. In our existing administration, there seems to be a push back towards saying Merry Christmas. So it's always kind of this dialogue happening. Are we trying to take Jesus out of Christmas, keep Christ out of Christmas? There was actually a couple of years ago, let me get the exact title of the organization, the American Humanist Association, which doesn't believe in God, that sent out a campaign. It was a godless holiday campaign. And they put up all these slogans, particularly in New York City, that you would see the slogan and it would say, no God, N-O, no God, my question, no God, no problem. Be good for goodness sake. No God, no problem. Just be good for goodness sake. That was their whole holiday campaign slogan. It's okay not to have God, they were saying, in the holidays. No God, no problem, just be good for goodness sake. Now, let's be real. You can't take Christ out of Christmas, right? No matter who tries, you can't take Christ out of Christmas. It's almost like the big discussion about taking prayer out of the schools. I've always said, like, you can't take prayer out of schools as long as there are math tests. There will be prayer in schools as a kid makes that last moment prayer to God to help him pass the math test. So whatever efforts are to take Christ out of Christmas, at the end of the day, Christ will always be a part of Christmas. Let me let you in on a little secret. Merry Xmas. Do you know that X is actually the Greek letter chi? And the Greek letter chi is a symbol of Christ. And it was really kind of an abbreviation for his name. So in the early centuries of the church, Xmas actually meant Christmas because the X is the Greek letter chi. I'm not sure everybody that uses Xmas today is using that symbolism, but I find it ironic that sometimes we as Jesus followers get really worked up over stuff like trying to pull Christ out of Christmas. You know what I'm far more concerned about? I'm far more concerned about our tendency as Jesus followers to live life as if there is no Christ. That's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about our tendency to live life as if Jesus had no impact on my life. I'm not so concerned about the efforts of the American Humanist Association to put slogans throughout New York City. I'm not a fan of that, and obviously I would speak out against that, but I am far more concerned about those of us that fill up the seats of what we call churches throughout the United States, living everyday life as if there is no Christ, that has no impact in our lives. Some people call it practical atheism, that I live as if there were no Jesus, no God impacting my life. Many Christians live a life unaffected by Jesus, or as if Jesus was just a piece of the puzzle that we call life. Matthew chapter 2 is our text today. Grab your Bible, go there. We're going to walk through a text together from the first Christmas story about a notorious villain, the very first Christmas villain. Now, this character in the Christmas story, I have to tell you, he doesn't make the Christmas cards. You're not going to open up a Christmas card from someone and find the story of Herod. You're not going to find the Butcher of Bethlehem on your Christmas cards. The Massacre of the Innocents is often called. Doesn't make the Christmas cards. But this was someone that truly wanted and tried to eliminate the Christ of Christmas. And what we discover from history and from the scriptures is that he put his life together like a puzzle, and he tried to eliminate any piece of the puzzle that did not fit his desires, his agenda. We'll get into our text in just a moment. Let me tell you a little bit about King Herod that we'll find in our text. This is a man that in history had some serious issues. And I believe that King Herod, a lot of the issues that he struggled with, even though they manifest themselves differently, they're not so removed from my personal sin or the things that we struggle with in our lives. And what we find out is that Herod constructed his life like a puzzle. He put a lot of pieces together, and his life was comprised of some very interesting pieces. Let me tell you the primary puzzle pieces that made up the life of Herod, and we'll see how those kind of reflect our lives as well, particularly during the Christmas season. The first piece of the puzzle was power. Now, power is the ability to, or the attempt to control my resources in order to kind of dictate my future. I want to be in control. I want to control my resources. I want to be in control so that I can dictate my future. Herod was addicted to power, and he possessed it. He had it. He had power. There are three basic words that define the power that Herod had. One, he was capable. In other words, he had power, and soon after becoming king, he wiped out several kind of guerrilla armies in that day that were terrorizing the countryside, and he used his subtle and intentional diplomacy to make peace with a lot of competing factions that were in the kingdom. So he was a very capable leader. He has a very capable power, but he was also very crafty. His power was a crafty power. You see, Herod tended to arrange all of his relationships as kind of conduits for his power. If you did not benefit him, if you did not benefit his agenda, then you were out. And he trusted no one. So he was a very capable leader that had a lot of power that he used in a very crafty way, and it made him very cruel. You see, he held tightly to the reins of power, and Herod basically brutally eliminated anyone who got in his way. During his reign, he murdered thousands of people, had thousands of people killed, including his brother-in-law, his mother-in-law, two of his sons, one of his wives, had them all murdered at different times during his rule and reign. He murdered out of spite, and he killed to stay in power. The Roman historian Josephus, that wrote a lot about the first century, is where we get a lot of our kind of extra biblical material from, is from a guy named Josephus who wrote a lot about that era. Here's what Josephus had to say about Herod the Great. He said he was barbaric. He was the malevolent maniac. Josephus said it was better to be the pig of Herod than to be his son. He was a ruthless tyrant who was willing to do whatever was necessary to maintain his power and control. Capable, crafty, cruel, dangerous combination when you have power. Not only was Herod a man of power, but he was a man of possessions. Possessions was a piece of his puzzle. He had a lot. He controlled a lot. He made known his wealth. He wanted it all. Herod was not a Roman Caesar. He liked to think of himself as a Caesar. The Caesars of that day were considered almost gods. And so Herod built for himself 7 palaces. He built a theater that would seat up to 9,500 people. Can you imagine that structure in the first century? A theater for himself that would seat thousands of people. He had all types of stadiums built that would seat, total in the stadiums, over 300,000 people that would get together to honor Caesar and to worship Herod in this case. He had a new temple constructed. He was consumed with possessions, a desire for more and bigger and better. He was also a man of prestige, power, prestige. You see, Herod wanted to make a name for himself. As a matter of fact, he gave himself a title. He called himself Herod the Great. Like, no one else gave him that title. He gave himself that title, Herod the Great. I think I'm going to try that at home. I should have everyone in my house refer to me as Devin the Great. How do you think that's going to work out for me? I'm getting like all these no's, like, and it's not just like, no, I'm not going to do it. It's like, are you kidding me? Like, sassy no, head shakes. Herod the Great, a self-acclaimed, self-appointed title. He built cities with state-of-the-art architecture. He had amenities that he named after his superiors. He was a smooth-talking manipulator who won over many enemies because of his ability to persuade people. Herod was married 10 times. Most of his marriages were for his own prestige, a power play somehow, some type of political advancement. He even married the daughter of his biggest rival to win him over to his side. He was a man that was obsessed with prestige. And then, if you read history, Herod was a man that had deep paranoia, like he was paranoid about everything. You see, Herod did not come into his throne naturally. He wasn't the son of a great king that by bloodline inherited the throne. As a matter of fact, Herod was an outsider. His father was poisoned, and Herod basically bought his throne. He was not a pure descendant, and it made him paranoid. So here's what Herod would do. He ordered thousands of slaves to build 10 emergency fortresses that he could go to at any time to escape if necessary. He had an elaborate network of spies that worked within the kingdom to reveal anyone that might be an enemy. He killed any threat. He trusted no one. And Herod ruled for over 40 years. He was hated. He was feared. Herod was so wicked that he made a rule, made a law, that when he died, thousands of people were to be killed so that he could ensure that grieving was taking place when he died. Hated, feared, paranoid. He was a man who had no room for another king. He had no room for Christ. He had no room for Jesus. And it is into this dark world, into this depraved rule and reign of a maniac, that Jesus was born. Sometimes we sanitize the picture. Sometimes we clean it up with our manger scenes. And sometimes the nativity scenes on our mantles are all clean. And we strategically place the shepherds and they look all clean. And the wise men are at the manger scene. And the baby Jesus looks like he's 3 years old and polished and clean. And Mary definitely does not look like she just had a baby in our nativity scenes. We love to clean up and sanitize the Christmas story. But at the end of the day, Jesus was born into the world of a maniac, into a dark and depraved world in desperate need of a Savior. Like we think our political climate is tough, the back and forth and this and that, and said this, said that, didn't do that, media, and all the things that play into our current political climate. Like we think it's a complicated political world that we live in. Nothing like the world of Herod. A dark, depraved, sinful world. And into this space, Jesus arrived. Let's kind of walk through the story together, Matthew chapter 2. Now that you kind of know the backstory of this guy named Herod. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king. So just that phrase, in the days of Herod the king, everything I just told you is wrapped up in that phrase. In the days of Herod the king. In the days of the obsessed by power, possessions, prestige, paranoia, capable, crafty, cruel, dark, sinful king. In the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he? Think about the backstory. Where is he who's been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and we have come to worship him. So here's Herod, the ruler of Judea, the city of Bethlehem, and these magi show up. These wise men from another country. And they're asking this question, where is the king of the Jews? What a question to ask the leader that we just described. Where is the king of the Jews? Not only that, where is he? But we have come to what? To bow down, to worship him, to show our allegiance to him. Where is the king of the Jews? Now, the Magi, they assume that this Messiah would be known. Like, a Messiah being born is a big deal. And so they assume, like, Herod must know about this. He's applauding, like, that like everybody, this must be a big deal, must be an uproar that the king has been born. So they naturally go to the palace, like, where is the king of the Jews that's been born? We've seen his star, like, show us where he is. By the way, the Magi probably arrive, you know, at least a year and a half, 2 years after Jesus is born. So like the wise men at the nativity scene is not really an accurate portrayal of history. The wise men actually show up when Jesus is probably a toddler. And so they naturally go to the palace, like, where is this king of the Jews? Let's look at Herod's response, verse 3. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. This word troubled is the word disturbed. It means to shake violently. Get the picture. Herod is rattled to his bones, to shake violently, because Jesus, this Messiah, this King of the Jews, is a threat to a powerful, manipulative, kill anyone who gets in my way king like Herod. By this time, Herod is near the end of his rule and reign. He doesn't want drama. Another king rattled to his bones. Now that expression, all Jerusalem was afraid as well. Why was Jerusalem afraid? They were afraid because Herod was shaken. And when Herod gets rattled, guess what happens? People die. Things happen. So Jerusalem is afraid because they realize Herod the Great, Herod the Evil, the depraved king, he's afraid. What is Herod going to do? So look what Herod does. Verse 4. He assembles all the chief priests and scribes of the people, and he inquired of them where the Messiah, the Christ, was to be born. And they told him, in Bethlehem of Judea. So it's been written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, the land of Judah, is quoting Micah here, and by no means least among the rulers of Judah, from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. So Herod calls together the religious leaders, tell me about this Messiah, where's he going to be born? And the religious leaders say he's going to be born in Bethlehem. So verse 7, Herod summons the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. Do we really think Herod had any desire to worship the Messiah, the King of the Jews? No. Herod wanted to eliminate the competition. His desire was to kill him, to destroy him, as we see the story played out. Go find this Messiah. Let me know so that I can worship God too. Hey, I want to tip my hat to this Messiah, this King of the Jews. Tip my hat to God. I want to show my allegiance to him. If you know the story, you know that's exactly what happened. The Magi do go, and they find Jesus. They worship him. They bring their gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh, and they worship the Christ child. But then something happens. God warns them, doesn't he? He tells them, don't go back to Herod. Herod just wants to destroy the Messiah. As a matter of fact, he tells Joseph and Mary to run, to flee. And so they do. They go to the land of Egypt to get out of the potential threat of Herod. Pick up in verse 16. Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious. Now, it's one thing for us to get angry. It's one thing for us to respond in anger. Look what happens when Herod gets angry and feels like he's been manipulated. And he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. Can you imagine how cruel that is? Like, if you have a child that's that age, like, this is, you know, kind of the first year that it's kind of sinking in a little bit for Levi that something special is going on. And, you know, he's got his little, like, morning routine that he lets the dog out of the kennel. This is what happens with baby Levi when he gets up in the morning after he's kind of had his milk. His routine is he wants down to let Toby out. He knows how to unlatch the kennel. And then Toby's routine is he comes out of his kennel and obviously wants to go to the bathroom at the back door. So Levi walks over to the door, hits on the door because he knows he's got to open the bedroom door. He goes out of the bedroom, and now, because it's the Christmas season, instead of going straight to the back door where he knows Toby goes out, you know what he does first? He goes to the Christmas tree and points because he knows we're supposed to turn on the Christmas tree lights. He knows something different is going on. So he's, you know, learning to unwrap gifts. He's learning about this, the specialness of this season. He doesn't really know what's going on, right? He just knows it's unique and different. And I thought about when I was preparing the message this week, like, how cruel is it? How evil is it? That because a king got furious, that our child could be murdered, taken, killed on the spot. Can you imagine the depth of grief and pain and hurt and loss that occurred in thousands of homes in that region of that day? Jesus was born into a cruel, cruel, dark, and sinful world. Every child, male child, two and under, will die. Like Herod's paranoia, his threat, his insecurity knows no limits. All kids, all male children, two and under, murdered, killed. The pain and the hurt that goes with that, we can't even wrap our minds around, can we? Verse 19. But when Herod, what? Died. Herod died. Behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to in a dream to Joseph in Egypt. Behold, right, Herod died. Herod died. He lived completely for himself, and then he died. A man who was so consumed with his own kingdom and his own throne that he had no space for Jesus and no space for a king. In the end, it cost him everything. He died. That's what happened. With all of his power and his possessions and his paranoia, at the end of the day, Herod, like you and like me, he died. It's over. He's dead. Herod dies. And he lived his whole life trying to make a name for himself. And at the end, he has four words in the text. But when Herod died, when he had died. You see, most of us are not Herod in our actions. Hopefully none of us are going to leave here and go out and kill our mother-in-law because we're paranoid. Hopefully none of us are going to go and slaughter people because we think they're somehow a threat. Most of us are not Herod in our external actions. But all of us have a Herod residing and living in our hearts and in our souls. All of us live with what I call throne tension. We live with this tension of who occupies the throne of my heart. Who occupies the throne of my soul? All of us are controlled with our own forms of power and possessions and prestige and paranoia. Think about it. All of us at some level have a throne tension in our hearts that power is trying to get to that throne, that we are tempted to try to control and to be in control, to have power over our own lives and our own hearts. We live trying to get power, to keep power, to use it for our own agenda. We may not be a power monger like Herod was, but we struggle with control issues, don't we? Controlling our own life, dictating our own future. We all struggle with our own control and our own manipulation and using other people to try to get our way. And whatever little slice of power that we can kind of carve into our lives, we want to get it and control it and keep it, and we want all hands off. who occupies the throne of my heart? Man, we don't like to be controlled. I don't want a king to reign over me. You know what following Jesus means, just by the idea that I'm following someone else, that I have to relinquish power. I have to relinquish control. I have to follow someone else. I have to fall under the allegiance of someone else. By nature, following Jesus is relinquishing power and control over my own heart, my own life, my own steps. And Jesus used that language, didn't he? He's like, take up your cross and follow me. He used a lot of language of dying to ourselves to follow him, of relinquishing control. Sure, we want Jesus to be a piece of our puzzle. We just don't want him to control our life. Like, we want to give him some space. We want to tip our hat to him. We want to mention him. We want to show up at church. We want to call ourselves Christians, but do we give him complete control? Do I give Jesus control of my relationships, or do I try to control them? Do I give Jesus control of my money, or do I try to control it? Do I give control to Jesus of my future? Do I give control to Jesus of my job? Do I give Jesus control of my insecurities and my doubts and my worries and my anxiety? Do I relinquish control to follow Jesus in the everyday? Our power struggles are not, I'm occupying an earthly throne, ruling and reigning over a kingdom, and what competing king is trying to rule and reign over me? Who do I need to eliminate and kill? That's not our power struggles. Our power struggles are far more personal, aren't they? Am I willing to trust Jesus to be in control of the everyday matters of life? And when we do not relinquish control, the result is that we live our lives filled with worry and anxiety and trying to get ahead and one up the person at work. We sit on the throne of our hearts and we try to piece together our lives like a puzzle. And here's my Jesus piece. And as long as it fits in the rest of my puzzle, everything will be okay. Power. What about possession? I'm afraid sometimes that we are obsessed with the visible when what matters most is the invisible. We are obsessed with the temporary when what matters most is the eternal. Is there any time or season of the year that shows this more clearly than Christmas? Did you know this year, projections are that Americans will spend, ready for it? $465 billion buying stuff for Christmas. $465 billion. Man, we live life trying to obtain more and upgrade and measure up and surpass, and possessions control us. And Jesus said in Matthew 6, like, God and stuff can't both occupy the throne of your heart. You're going to give allegiance to one or the other. And possessions control us. What about prestige? Always trying to get ahead, regardless of what I have to sacrifice. Family, friends, time, my character. Always trying to make a name for myself, to get a head up, to get a step ahead, to make a name for myself in culture and my friendships and my social circle. Always putting on the face to make everything seem okay when everything's falling apart behind the scenes. Am I seeking to put prestige on the throne of my life and to live a life marked by prestige? Sure, I'm not building temples, and sure, I'm not giving myself titles like Herod the Great. That's not our reality, but our reality is prestige wars at our soul, trying to take control. For what am I known to other people? When people at work think about me, what do they think about? When my social circle thinks about me as a person, what do they think about? When my family thinks of me, what do they think about? What am I doing to try to constantly make a name for myself or to create some type of persona? What does my reputation say about my priorities in life? Prestige. What about paranoia? Paranoia is really just a fear of trusting. A lack of faith, a fear of trust. What am I afraid to trust? Especially when I'm asked to trust a God that doesn't always make sense. You know what I'm talking about? I'm afraid to trust because I can't always hear God. And sometimes in my most challenging moments, it seems maybe when God is the farthest away, my prayers seem to go answered or can't be heard in those moments. Am I willing to trust God, or do I have a lack or a fear of trusting? What if I've been hurt or burned in a relationship? What if I've been abused? What if I've been hurt growing up? What if someone close to me has hurt me tremendously and I have a very difficult time trusting? Again, paranoia seeks to occupy our thrones in life. Do I really trust God in all areas of my life? Do I really trust Him with my family? Do I really trust Him with my finances? Do I really trust God with my future? Like, we can go through the list, can't we? Do I really trust God? And here's a challenging question for me. What am I doing in my life right now that requires absolute faith in God to come through? Do I live with a level of paranoia that keeps me in a comfort zone? That I can see it, and I can feel it, and I can touch it, and I can budget it, and I can grasp it and hold it and control it? Or do I live life as a follower of Jesus that pushes me to the borders of common sense, that pushes me to say, what areas of my life am I being stretched right now where it doesn't make sense to do this, or it doesn't make sense to follow in this direction? What is requiring me in my life right now to absolutely trust God and God alone because I can't make it happen? Power, possessions, paranoia. Like, it's still the same stuff as it was for Herod. It looks different, but it's still the same thing. You know what faith asked me to do? Faith says to me, Devin, relinquish control and trust God. You see, we are Herod, aren't we? We're Herod. That's why we need the gospel. Because we are Herod. We have a tendency to live life in our own control. And if we removed Jesus from our lives, very little would change. You know why? Because we occupy the throne of our hearts. And if we took Jesus out, very little would change. You see, Jesus is a piece of our puzzle. But if we lost the piece, I'm afraid that our lives would look very similar. Maybe a little incomplete, but very similar. We are Herod. Jesus does not want to just fit in our lives. He's King. He's King of Kings. He wants to lead, to be in control. He wants to occupy the throne of our hearts and lives. And what the gospel says is when Jesus leads, when Jesus is Lord, when Jesus is King, it is then and only then that we are able to live life to the fullest. It is only then that we find our lives whole and complete in Him. Because in Him, it's not about power and possessions and prestige and paranoia. In Him, it's about living a whole, complete, fulfilled life. Because He is in control and we can trust Him. Amen. Step by step, day by day. So the question for us is, when we think about Christmas for villains, we are the villain, aren't we? We are Herod. Which king are we serving today? Who's sitting on the throne of my heart and life? Of what do I need to relinquish control to keep Christ not at the center of Christmas, to keep Christ at the center of life, grounded in who Jesus is? I'm not going to end this message without reminding us, as we do every week, of the beauty of the gospel. Here's the beauty of the gospel. We are Herod. And the gospel says, Jesus came for Herod. Jesus came for villains. That's the story of Christmas. The light invades the darkness. Jesus entered into a dark world controlled by a man who was a wicked maniac. But Jesus entering into that dark space is saying, I'm entering a world of Herods. I'm entering a world of darkness. I'm entering a world of sinners so that I might bring life and restoration and forgiveness and healing to the Herods of the world. Part of the gospel is we have to recognize that we are in need of Jesus, that we are Herods at heart who need a Savior. And the beauty of the gospel is Jesus came to die for the Herods of the world. He came to die for you and me. While we were still sinners, God demonstrated his love for us. We are Herod. And that's the beauty of the gospel. Jesus came to die for villains, for Herods. Story of the Bible. God redeems sinners like you and like me. So as we enter into this holiday season that's in full swing now, maybe we need to hit the pause button for a moment to ask ourselves, who's occupying the throne of my heart? Who's sitting on the throne today? What am I trying to control? What am I trying to manipulate? What am I trying to have a heads up or a hand over? What am I doing? Am I giving Jesus control? My finances, my family, my future, my fears, my insecurities, my relationships. Maybe we need to hit the pause button and say, Jesus, during this season, let's not just keep Christ in Christmas. Let's keep Christ at the center of life. Because Jesus came to die for Herods like you and like me. So if you're here today and you're a Herod, sinner, recognize your own depravity. I invite you to believe in Jesus because he came to die for you. If you don't consider yourself a Herod, you're like, hey, I'm not that bad and I'm better than this person. Like, you need Jesus too, right? We are all Herods at heart that are trying to control, whether it's through our goodness or our wickedness, trying to control. And Jesus invades our darkness, comes into our space to bring light and life and hope. And this Christmas season, we worship him as King of the world and King of our own heart's throne.